Welcome. This is the UX Design Cast podcast series, and my name is Carl Vredenberg. This is episode number 32, and this is the design news version of the podcast. And I'm delighted to have on the session with me today, Jay Trimble, the group lead for the User-Centered Design Technology Group at NASA Ames Research Center. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you.
And next we have Keith Enstone, Information Architecture Lead with IBM CIO's office and responsible for the IBM.com site. Welcome, Keith.
Hi, welcome.
And last but certainly not least, we have Elian Tosman, User Interface Designer, IBM Media Design Studio. Welcome, Elian.
Hi, Carl. It's nice to be back.
Well, great to have all you guys back for another installment of our kind of month and a bit review of interesting happenings with regard to news, various things that have happened over the last while with regard to design. And so what we've done for this installment, as we do for all of these that we do, we've collectively captured in Delicious a list of our whole group's ideas on what was interesting that happened during this period of time. And we basically put the links in there and lined up the ones that we thought were appropriate to talk about in today's session. And so we'll go through that list. And I wanted to start off the list myself on something that IBM has just recently made available. And that is the IBM Lotus Connections version 2.5. And the reason why I think this is interesting to talk about with regard to design and also about all of the overall topic of social networking and social media is that this is an environment that is the combination of all of the kinds of things that you normally would associate with Web 2.0. Everything from, you know, wikis, from file sharing, from discussion forums, the whole notion of also, most recently, the ability to do microblogging. You know, when you think of systems like Twitter and all, there is a notion of doing microblogging. Now, all of that, when people do it normally today, they do all that kind of stuff out there beyond corporate firewalls. And there's certainly a need for doing that. There's also obviously a great desire for doing that as well. But there's also a need for doing that inside companies and organizations. And this Lotus Connections product, I think, is in that category. And I think I'm certainly excited about using it because I think it really does provide all the capabilities that we've had various solutions to on the general web thus far, but didn't really have in terms of an offering, at least. We've inside IBM, we tend to run things as a laboratory. And so we've actually been using various pieces of these solutions for some time, but not all in an integrated product. And this particular product, Lotus Connections 2.0, really does put all of that stuff in together. So now we can actually do microblogging inside the company. We can do, you know, quickie announcements just before we start a webcast or a podcast that's live that we want to have people join into. We can now have a core set of wikis and blogs and be able to control them and be able to, you know, tag and the like in there. So it's I'm real excited about it myself. Instances where I'm really excited about a product that IBM develops, I'd like to also tell all of you who are listening as well. So just wanted to introduce that one and also mention that we are working on a story, you know, that we have on our ibm.com/design website. We also have a design gallery where we feature particular products and particularly the design attributes of them, the innovations in design, the challenges that we had to address, the kind of user feedback we gathered on them and that kind of stuff. So this Connections 2.0 is a story that will be going up on that site shortly. And it'll also include a demo of the design features and some of the challenges and how we address those challenges and all that sort of thing as well. So I wanted to just draw everybody's attention to that and just ask anybody else on the panel whether they have any other items to add to this particular one.
I have a general comment on IBM and Lotus products as it relates to UX design, when it's appropriate, Carl.
Go ahead, Jay.
Well, you know, years ago, I think most of us used to think of IT technology as starting in the enterprise and then, you know, it would get to us And if you were lucky, your technology at home would catch up. And now I see it as a reverse. I often, actually most of the time, have more effective IT outside of my work than I do at work. And I've heard many people say that. And my point here in terms of UX design is I often read about capabilities in IBM products that I am fascinated by, but I never have access to try any of them. And unless my, you know, center level CIO decides to change that, that won't change. Whereas other products of this ilk, you know, they treat the world as a big beta test and they bring those features to all of us. And then they're also available in the enterprise, which I think has real implications for how they're designed and how they evolve. And of course, I'm also expressing a personal desire to be able to try some of these things.
Yeah. This is Keith. We've had a early version. The Lotus Connections is coming soon on IBM.com, right? So as an IBM customer, you can actually come and use that application on our site. So that's just one way that we're sort of getting the application out a little bit so that you can come to IBM.com and use more of our products and see how they work.
No, great stuff. And I think, you know, internally, just so you know as well, internal to IBM, our team that leads the design and user experience sort of practitioners across the company and really as an overall community, we're also increasingly leveraging, you know, this thing for our own, you know, benefit as well. And you'll see some of these characteristics, at least via demo and capability to go and try it in a variety of ways, including what Keith just talked about on IBM.com, you know, moving forward as well. So I think the point that I wanted to make about this particular one is, you know, we spend a lot of time on these disparate systems that are great to use externally, but there are times when you want to do some level of, you know, communication like a Twitter-like capability. And I've been desiring that actually to be able to have that as a mechanism to use, you know, inside IBM. And I'm confident that lots of other people have that same desire that they just don't. There's certain things you can say in a microblogging capability openly on Twitter, let's say, versus there's certain things that you can only say inside your company because it ends up being information that you can't share as readily. Like I said, there's also a need for this capability as well as integrated, and that's the point of this release, lots of capability all together in one place so you can have, you know, one tag, for example, and be able to actually see everything that's related to that tag, you know, whether that's a micro blogging comment or a wiki or a file share or a discussion forum that somebody may have contributed. So anyway, that's one that I wanted to get us started off from, but that wasn't certainly the only news that happened design-related inside or outside IBM. One of the other ones that I know, Eliane, you had identified was something I gave the title of typographical efficiency, something that IKEA has done over the last little while. I wonder if you could outline what IKEA did and its relevance to this topic.
Thanks, Carl. Yeah, well, what happened a little over a month ago was that IKEA abandoned 50 years of using a very strong font. And it's this whole topic revolves around, the whole discussion really revolves around the impact a font can have on a brand such as IKEA. So what they did is they decided to remove the 50 years of using a mix between Futura and Century Schoolbook for Verdana. Now, for those of you who know a bit about Futura, this was designed 82 years ago by a German designer, Paul Renner. And it's really, it has a very distinctive flavor to it. You know, it really represents in terms of a brand, on a brand level, and typographical values, it represents something that is, you know, strong, and it dates back to the constructivist era, which, you know, it has a very design flavor to it. And what they did, and this is why it's so drastic, they decided to go with a font, Verdana. Now, Verdana is very new. It was designed in 1993 by Matthew Carter and was commissioned by Microsoft. And to quote Matthew Carter, he really designed this to, for computer screens. It's not designed for type. Whereas Futura, of course, was primarily designed for type as it was designed 82 years ago. And he really designed it because it was clear and it worked well with many languages. And it even works in small point sizes. So they really took, they removed themselves from their really strong beautiful, and it wasn't quite, I mean, they did modify it from a Futura, making it IKEA Sans, so it was their own proprietary font. And they changed it to, you know, to accommodate their own style, but it really was a mark of IKEA when you saw those big, bold letters. You know, it was so distinguishable, and that they decided to go with an everyday font that's used by thousands. Apparently, it's the most used font in everywhere. So, and again, it's really not meant for print. It's really meant for computer usage. So they really decided to, you know, to change their identity. So there was an outcry by, you know, by many, by the, you know, the graphic designers that said, how could they, you know, how could they do this? You know, they're using a cheap font, really. And that's how, you know, it's prefab, it's ready-made. It's not as, it's bland, you know. So then people are saying, well, you know, they're going, at the end, their furniture is really cheap and it doesn't have that distinguished, you know, the distinguished flavor, the Swedish flavor that everyone associates with. So, you know, a lot of people are saying now that, you know, that they, it can really impact their brand identity because, as we all know, people do make choices based on brand identity. And they're saying that people do notice fonts, the letters. It's not just graphic designers. So the real question today that a lot of people are asking themselves is that, is it true? Will it tarnish their brand? Will it make such an impact as the design community thinks it will?
I found this story to be a really interesting one, Eliane, and really a sort of three levels. You know, one is the one that you're talking about, you know, what implications does this kind of a change have on a brand and the overall sort of visual signature, if you will, of a company. The other aspect that I thought was interesting was whether, well, just the overall reaction that people that are into typography had on this, but also interestingly, how people that are not into this were kind of ho-hum about all of it. Like, okay, well, all of our typographical friends and graphical designers are all getting really up in arms about this, but it's a font, is sort of what others sort of responded with. And what I think is interesting about all of this is when we look at the total user experience and we talk about all the various elements that incorporate into that total user experience, something like the choice of font is, by the people that are specialists in that, really, really important. And for good reasons, I think. But what's interesting, too, is I wonder whether the people that don't care about, you know, this issue, whether they somehow, and whether everybody that looks at this somehow does notice the difference, or they may not notice it sort of cognitively, but they will, but they may viscerally or you know, affectively, emotionally, or maybe not at all. I'm just intrigued by, especially given the uproar that this was caused, that this caused in the typographical community, what the real net result, you know, will be. Will there really be a difference, or is it just specialists that are getting all really concerned about this? Or is it the case that, you know, we are going to actually see a perceived a difference in reaction to, you know, material that now has, you know, this, you know, somewhat less elegant and, you know, font. I don't know. Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was sort of curious about, you know, like what's the real story behind it? Because I think the public response from IKEA was, well, we're going to save money by choosing this other font. But it seems to me there must be something else beneath the surface. And then for me, I'm thinking, guys, should I buy more IKEA stock, or should I sell what I have really fast? Right? What's going to be the impact on the stock price, on the business? And it would be great to have a little experiment where this was the only variable that changed, and now let's see what happens.
Absolutely right. And I wonder too whether, you know, in this case, the perception of, you know, this being less expensive, whether that is a maybe even something that they're trying to accomplish, right? That they're, you know, the furniture is very functional. It is, it does have good design. I mean, I'm actually, you know, really quite impressed, but they tend to be on the, you know, less expensive side in terms of furniture. You know, maybe it's actually an intended, you know, design decision and not just a, you know, a cost, you know, one. But anyway, I don't think I got clarity on that in what I read about the decisions regarding this. But like you say, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the reactions are. And, you know, maybe an A-B study would have been interesting in this particular instance as well. But I think there are definitely interesting things about this from a macro level, as well as from a discipline level and from a, you know, an actual customer feedback level as well. So we'll have to just stay tuned on this one, I think. Anybody else have any other thoughts on this one?
Well, just to add also, what was really interesting too is that there, you know, people have been asking, interviewing IKEA and say, well, why did you do this? Of course, Keith, as you were saying, it's because it's cost effective. And also there was another answer that was given, which I thought was interesting, was because it's really easy when you translate it. You know, you don't have to, in all languages it works. So, which I thought was interesting because they are such a global company. And that was just a tidbit that I found. But I loved their font, the Futura. I love Futura. I think it's such a great font. So it's sad to kind of see it go for Verdana, which is so overused.
Yeah, and I did. I looked at the catalog and I noticed it. But then I tend to be, you know, a little more maybe than, or all of us more than the average person. But I wonder what the average person's reaction to it would be. We'll just have to follow this story. But I thought that was another one that was interesting. And Eliane, thanks for raising that. The next one that I wanted to draw attention to, and I also blogged about this, is I did a bunch of thinking this over the last while about cloud computing, and we've talked about this before too, the whole notion of putting your data in the cloud. And, you know, that name comes from this notion that we typically in architecture and design discussions in the past, when people would draw putting data somewhere in some server that was remote from the person, they always used to draw that as a cloud. And so that's now the commonly used definition of, or the word that's used for data that don't reside on your own machine, and also the capability typically of accessing it and working with it using rich internet application kind of capability in the browser. What was interesting was that lots of people have been talking about instances when, you know, Gmail goes down for some numbers of minutes or some other, you know, major service is unavailable for a bit. And in actual fact, the lengths of time that typically talking about there are not terribly long, right? And I've often sort of referred to that as being, well, you know, what do we expect there? We tend to hold a rather high bar, I think, and that's probably reasonable still, but a fairly high bar for uptime for the service itself and the data to be accessible. But one of the things that I experienced with my ISP over the last while was some real unreliability for long periods of time. And, you know, having the problem of the internet connection going down and calling for help and being told that, you know, you need to do a gazillion steps to test things, then all they're doing is going through the support script to determine what the problem might be. Going and screwing up your machine often, you know, trying to go through all these steps when you really are pretty confident the problem is not, you know, on your system or inside your own house or organization's location. But then, and then at the 11th hour, almost literally so, you get the word from the ISP saying, that, oh yeah, you know, a bunch of their servers were down and the expected uptime is 4 hours from now. And so you now have this situation where we talk about these services, these cloud-based services and their degree of availability or their uptime. But it seems to me that we often don't include in this whole equation the ISP, the role of the actual connection wherever you are through the pipes of the internet, so to speak, to that service. Those things are critically important too. And in my experience, and talked to a bunch of colleagues about this and friends too over the last while, that seems to be sort of the Achilles heel of a lot of this. And a lot of the ISPs don't seem to take as seriously, in my view, as they should, the whole notion of uptime. And that having, you know, somebody come out to your house to fix an internet connection and having those appointments be able to be scheduled the next day or maybe 2 days from now sort of thing, and you have no service during that whole time. I don't know what you guys have in terms of your experience with ISPs, But it strikes me that that doesn't make sense, or that's certainly several fold, you know, difference in terms of time than having, you know, one of these cloud services themselves go down for some amount of time. And ultimately, it's the full chain. The weakest link in the chain, you know, takes you down, and you still have unavailability of the information and the data that you're trying to access. So I just wanted to raise that as we talk often now about the cloud and the availability of services, that we've got to think of the total user experience with cloud type offerings, which includes players that don't, I think, you know, buy in yet to the notion of the kind of uptime that they need to get to in order to use these kinds of services. Anybody have thoughts on that?
I think it's a good point. But I think it just brings up the broader issue that if you want access to your data all the time, there needs to be an effective working offline mode, which I believe people are working on, right? Google Gears and the new HTML standards. I just think those things are in their infancy at the moment. But they're starting. You also even see under offline mode access, Carl, I believe, a flaky internet connection mode.
Right.
My only point is that there's some thought going into it, and it definitely is something that needs to be addressed.
No, I think you're right. And so the people that are designing the services are providing things like offline, you know, mode, disconnected mode, and the like, as you say. And I think that's really important. You know, auto saves, you know, as well. I've blogged about that too. All of those kinds of capabilities are really important that the service provider, the of the cloud service themselves, needs to be providing in terms of that total user experience. But I think what I'm getting at is I think that there are also other companies in the mix here that need to realize that they are in fact in the mix and aren't just in there for providing a service that, you know, with many people now working from home, you know, a bunch of the time, you know, personally sort of access to ISPs is getting to be more important. And I got, you know, a real appreciation over the last little while that, yeah, even if I've got, and I did have a bunch of the material sort of cached or stored locally, but I still couldn't have direct access to the services themselves because, you know, that was the missing link. But you make an excellent point that we need to deal with a whole variety of the options of dealing with this availability problem. But I think what I'm saying is that the vendors that provide the cloud service and the applications in that cloud aren't the only ones that need to be addressing this problem. The next item that we wanted to talk about was some other news that happened during the last while, and that was designing for multiple browsers. And we saw the announcement of Google Chrome Frame. And Keith, can you just tell us a little more about what that is and what that accomplishes?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for folks that develop websites and are trying to do more advanced things, there's always been a struggle of, you know, how many different browsers do you support? How far back? You know, what's the oldest version of a browser that you have to support? Because sometimes, you know, that can take you 10 times longer to catch a bug for an older version of a browser than it is to do it for the more up-to-date ones. And so what Google's come out with is this thing called Chrome Frame, which is a plugin for Internet Explorer that when the plugin kicks in, then it makes IE act, you know, a little bit more like the modern browsers, right? It has a more efficient JavaScript engine and you know, lots of other things like that. So it sort of it acts more like the, you know, the latest and greatest Firefox and other things. So it's an interesting development because it's always a, you know, tricky part of designing for certain plugins and that, but it is an interesting way to sort of, you know, here's the basic browser, but if you can get the right plugin installed you know, on the user's machine, then you can, you know, you can really make more advancements in the user experience.
And I think the bane of any designer's existence is having to deal with cross browser inconsistencies, where you spend, I think, way too much of a designer's time and then also a developer's time trying to deal with all of the, you know, idiosyncrasies and the, you know, that certain browsers just don't support certain kind of capabilities. If you do want to do rounded corners of buttons or, and the like, and that's your desire as a designer, that's how something needs to look. And you then have certain browsers that don't support that you need to go do all kinds of extra effort to make, you know, the the design that you came up with work in a particular browser. I think the challenge is that people that are building browsers need to really get behind the common standard. And as a result, I mean, this is the impact on designers. Designers should be designing what that user experience should be for people that are going to be using the web and tools and rich internet applications and the like that that they're responsible for. And I think that we'd end up with, you know, far superior designs if we actually had these browsers to be more consistent. And I think in the words that a lot of the announcements that we've heard recently about browsers, you know, referred to as modern browsers are there supporting sort of the latest standards. And I think those latest standards are always supportive of designers' desires to do the best possible designs. And I think where browsers are lagging behind, you know, those standards, that's where you've got the real challenge in trying to design an optimal user experience. And so I think, you know, in this case, Google is trying to provide a capability for creating a level playing field for, you know, the user experience across browsers, and doing it in kind of an interesting, a very unorthodox way of providing a plugin for IE with regard to this. I did want to make the point that this is early days, I think, for the Chrome Frame effort, and that I was talking to somebody that's an expert in accessibility, and apparently the, you know, while you now have the capability when you're using Frame of supporting, you know, the latest standards, even within IE, apparently that's only available to a subset of the overall audience, because apparently they're the level of accessibility support in terms of designing for all users isn't there. So even that still needs some attention moving forward. But I think it's interesting, though, from an overall approach to creating a consistent experience across browsers, I think it's an interesting development that I think and I hope we'll actually start to see, you know, more convergence and more support for standards, so we can actually design more, you know, superior user experiences.
It's a very valid point, because, you know, there's so much richness that you can design with for now with, you know, with the quote unquote the modern browsers. I mean, you can do visually, you can do so much, and there is so much potential as well, but yet you're held back. And even with the, you know, with the new CSS3, where it really allows you as a designer to do a lot of stuff that you weren't able to do, you know, 2 years ago. And yet, you know, there's you can smell it. It's like a candy that's dangled in front of you, except wait, you can't do it, because you still have to design for the lowest common denominator, and it's not really that lowest common denominator is not up to par with the other browsers. So it's really limiting for designers and interaction designers in terms of really doing their best and producing absolutely stellar designs. So I think on that level, what, you know, the Google Frame, I think, is great, because it will kind of, like, you know, it's an injection saying boost here. Let's move forward, and make something stellar.
Yeah, it's my sense that it's less of the detail of this particular, you know, announcement with regard to the particular capabilities and whether this will live for a long time or not. But it's more a matter of saying, you know, a stake in the ground, saying let's actually get to some level of commonality across browsers that will allow the kind of design you were just describing, Eliane. And I think, you know, its relevance to design is it will then, I think, improve a lot for designers and the users of systems to be able to actually have richer and more consistent experiences, which takes us to the next story, talking about rich internet application experiences. This is a story, Eliane, that you had bookmarked. I wonder if you could talk about designing effective RIAs.
Yeah, I came across this this really great article that, you know, you read a lot about, you know, rich internet applications, and you see which ones, you know, are good. But this one really stood out because it was very well thought. There was a lot of research into it, and their points were just fantastic. First of all, they say, you know, they point to make a really good rich internet application, you need to follow some rules. So first of all, you know, they point to Jacob Nielsen's usability heuristics that are, you know, that are very old, over 10 years old. So, you know, there's 10 things that that make it a good good in terms of usability. So that's feedback, metaphor, navigation, consistency, prevention, memory, efficiency, design, recovery, and help. So those are just your basics, right? And then it goes into number two, what's important in to make it a rich, to make it really rich. And it's not, you know, developing a product with Ajax, Flash, Dojo, Silverlight doesn't really make it inherently rich. A usable RIA will embody six principles, and they really state the principles very well. One is to make it direct. You know, where there is output, let there be input. So, you know, for direct manipulation, instead of going to a separate page to edit the content, it can be done inline, directly in the page. So they note that the following products that they've chosen uses a variety of interaction patterns, screen layouts, and controls to make it direct. So it really does, you know, in that sense, it makes it very rich. And two is keep it lightweight. And I think this is true for any, you know, product that you design, not necessarily RIA, but keep it lightweight. I really like that. So it's all about keeping a light, you know, keep it simple, you know. So keeping a light footprint, when a user interacts with an application, it should be in a way that causes at least amount of physical and mental effort. So why don't you keep it everything on the same page or use the same tools? And number three is stay on the page. People don't really, there's been data that proves that people don't really like to be disturbed. They don't like their pages to be refreshed all the time. So instead of disrupting the user's mental flow, is keep all the content on one page instead of going from one page to the next. And this can be done really with rich internet applications. So you're no longer bound by technical limitations. And that's a great one. And then there's provide an invitation. So discover something. Five, which is something that I really, we're doing a lot of research into, is animation and various effects that you can have within the rich internet application to enhance the delight, to enhance the engagement, and to enhance the communications. So the following sites that they've listed uses really well, they use transitions in a really profound way that enhances the overall user experience. So I thought that one was really good. And the last one is React Immediately. So responsive interface is an intelligent interface. And I thought that was great. Now the 50 that they do list, I thought were, you know, visually stunning. Interaction was really great. You know, it makes the point. It's easy to go through. And I thought that, you know, I came across this article and I thought that, wow, they've listed 50 great RIAs, and they really did. So that's why I thought that was interesting.
And what I particularly liked about the piece that you've been pointing out too, Eliane, is the fundamentals of the attributes of a really good RIA, rich internet application. And they make the point that with the capabilities in the browser now within this whole area called rich internet application, you can, with all the increased degrees of freedom, you can actually do a really great job, and you can also do a really horrible job. And so you can do any number of things within this new browser environment, all the capabilities that we have. But I think they've done a really nice job of articulating the core attributes, as you say, the fundamental principles, and also gave some great examples of, you know, the kinds of things that were, for example, if you're going to do animation, you want to reinforce an action, you want to draw attention to something that just changed on the screen, since you're not refreshing pages or navigating between different pages, as you say. You now have something that's on the, consistent on the same page, but some information was just updated. You want to actually do some level of animation, some sort of visual effect that actually indicates that thing changed. But doing it subtly, so it just grabs your attention a bit and draws attention to it, as opposed to really overdoing animation and the like as well, simply because you're able to do it. So I thought it was an excellent piece, and I will be pointing out that the links that we're talking about here will be available in the show notes site after our session, you know, as well, so you can have a look at the various things we've talked about, but also look particularly at the examples that you just described, Eliane, terms of the 50 RIAs and also the lessons learned, I think, from designing good ones and then looking at those as examples.
Yeah, I thought it was a good list, great attributes. It was kind of funny. Somewhere in my library, in my attic, I have a book on developing things for HyperCard. And I know it's very similar to this list. So a lot of it's, you know, for us old timers, like, yep, this is a good way to design applications, but it is nice to finally be able to do it in a browser.
Okay, lastly, and this is an item that isn't so much looking back as it is looking forward, we wanted to talk about the upcoming World Usability Day and planning that's going into that. And Keith, you want to talk to that?
Yeah. So World Usability Day will be November 12th. Is it the 4th or 5th? I can't remember now which one. But it's an annual event, always in November, that's sponsored mainly by the Usability Professionals Association as a way to, raise awareness of usability and good user experiences. Some of the initial inspiration was like Earth Day, right? I guess, you know, you're not important unless you have your own day once out of the year, right? So as Earth Day picked up steam and people started becoming more aware of it, then that was good for everybody's overall awareness. So it's sort of in that spirit. There's a lot of events organized around the world, so there's still chance to go to the worldusabilityday.org website and find an event near you that you can attend or even organize your own event. There should still be enough time to even organize something. The type of event, the theme is sustainability, so again, tying into the environmental theme. Different parts of the world organize different things. Sometimes it's more like a conference. Sometimes it's something more geared like at a museum where you can interact with regular people and talk about these issues. It really depends on what you want to do locally. But it is, over the years I've been involved, and it really is amazing to have all these people engaged all on the same day, all the way around the world.
It's a great event, as you say, for the objectives that were originally stated. For, like you said, get a single event on a single day, draw attention to this topic. And the previous ones, I guess you've been involved in doing ones locally around your place of work and where you live. I know a number of others, certainly IBM design people, have been involved in this, and you've been helping with the organization of a lot of this, Keith. I think one of the things that we're looking to do this year, and we would suggest that you stay tuned with regard to the website that we have, ibm.com/design, as well as stay tuned on Facebook. We'll probably be announcing some things that we may be doing for World Usability Day on our respective coordinates in the social networking sphere. So the website that I mentioned, the Facebook account, which is facebook.com/ibmdesign, as well as on Twitter, we're IBM Design on there too. And so look out for a variety of things to be communicated, but also to this very point, the event that, or the events that we will be engaged in as well across the board. And we're trying to get an event that we could have others, you know, more broadly involved in as well, both inside the IBM company and also outside, you know, IBM as well. So we'll see what we're going to be pulling together, but stay tuned with regard to the further planning on that. Well, that was sort of the rundown of the news items that we had sort of collected of things that have happened in the last little while, things that are going to be happening in the next little while. And hope you found those of some interest. And like I said, we'll also be making the links available on the show notes site, which is at uxdesigncast.com. So you can listen to this podcast there. You can also listen to it on ibm.com/design. And you also can subscribe to this overall podcast series in iTunes as well as in the Zune marketplace as well. So any of those places you can get that. And we're always looking for additional feedback that you may have on that as well, that you can use any of the feedback mechanisms we've talked about here. You can also provide a rating and some comments in iTunes as well as on the Zune marketplace capability as well. So with that, that's our summary for the last while. And we look to have another one of these in about a month's time, where we can look at what happened in the intervening time as well. So let me thank Elian, Jay, and Keith for your participation in this session, and want to thank all of you that are listening for your effort at following this podcast and listening to these sessions, and we'll talk to you all next time. And bye for now.